It's a very familiar one, Jesus washing the disciples' feet. The setting here, of course, is the Last Supper, and John, of the four Gospel writers, John writes the most complete account of what went on at the Final Supper before Jesus' arrest and his crucifixion. And John records the conversations. For instance, and it's in John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. All those chapters are simply an account of what Jesus said at the Last Supper. And it was a very special time because Jesus was meeting with his disciples for the last time. And the text starts out, chapter 13, now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he should depart from this out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during supper, the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, and girded himself about. Now, I think it's profitable to look at the historical setting for this event. One of the interesting things is that the Last Supper has become quite a theme of art, and Da Vinci's Last Supper has become the standard for most pictures. Y'all seen the picture of the Last Supper, which is... Like, I've even seen communion tables with it set in, you know, and carved in them. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that if you look at that and you look closely at the account of the Last Supper, a lot of things aren't going to make sense. The Wittenberg door, which is a kind of a sarcastic paper that, it's an evangelical paper that parodies a lot of things and sometimes makes some good points and sometimes goes too far. But they... one of their jokes about that particular picture of the Last Supper, you know, has Jesus saying, "Look, boys, if you all want to get in the picture, you're going to have to get on this side of the table." you know, they're all lined up. And if you're interested in this, I don't know why I said that, because I'm going to teach anyway. But they did not sit at a table. They sit in what was called a trivium. I don't have a blackboard here, but it was a set of... If you want to picture it, there was a set of three tables, set like a horseshoe. Picture it this way, like on a flat surface. This would be the table number one, this would be the table across, and the table down. And the people, they would recline with their feet away from the table, and then the servants could circulate on the inside of the horseshoe and serve the meal, the jaw. You'll picture that. In other words, here's the horseshoe, or the three tables, and... people, they're lying out, their feet outward from the table, and the servants circulating on the inside. Now, in this arrangement, the head of the table, by the way, was not where we might think. We would put the head of the table at the top of the horseshoe. That would be the. Remember, Jesus talked about those who love the chief seats at banquets. He says, if you enter a banquet, don't take the chief seat. You take a lower one, and then the master may ask you to move on up. But if you move right in and take one of the chief seats, and he says, no, that seat belongs to somebody else, then you'll be humiliated. And he says you ought not to. He's saying that you ought not to put yourself forward. You ought to be willing to accept the role of the servant. And then if the master wants to elevate you, that's his business, not your business. That's the teaching on that. But and it was a custom in the ancient Near Eastern world that where you sat depended upon how close you were to the master of the feast. And the head of the... if you can picture this, again, this horseshoe arrangement, the head of the master sat at the second... The head table was the one on this side. Can you picture that? The table on this side. And the chief seat was the one that was second from the end. You got that? Second from the end. And the master and they faced toward the open end of the horseshoe. So here's the horseshoe, people lying around, their feet out, the three tables, the servants serving from the middle, And the second from the end on this side was where the master of the feast sat. You ever pictured it that way? It doesn't look much like Da Vinci's Last Supper, does it? Where he put the chief seat in the middle. By the way, if you understand that's how it was, and the foot of the table, the foot of the table was the other end. Understand that was, so the chief seats were and those who were the most honored guests always sat on the right, either side of the master of the feast. So that would put one of the honored guests right at the end, one end of the horseshoe. And then in descending degrees of importance in most feasts, they would sit around, and at the other end, the foot of the table, was the one opposite. If you were to flatten this out, here's the master of the feast, on either side of him are the two chief guests. They're lying this way, facing this way. And then they go around, and over there is the foot of the table. By the way, look at your text in John chapter 13, it helps you understand this. Jesus said, look at John 13:23. Now what happened, I'll give you an educated guess what happened that night. You know, the text, we read in the first part of this chapter that Judas had entered, Satan had entered Judas' heart. And Judas apparently, underline the word apparently, decided that the bold approach was the best. So when they came in, and they, when they came in and took their seats, Judas, I think, took Peter's seat. Who were the two closest disciples to Jesus? Peter and John. And we know that John, I'll tell you why in a minute, we know that John was on this end of the horseshoe. He was on this side of Jesus. Then came Jesus. Next should have been Peter. But Judas took Peter's seat because he was going to play it bold because he knew he was going to betray the Lord. We know that Judas was sitting there. I'll tell you why in a minute. We know he was sitting there. Peter, you know how Peter was. He got mad and went to the foot of the table. He said, "Well, if I can't have my seat," like a lot of church members. "Well, if I can't have my seat, I'll just, you know," which is normally next to Jesus. We know that I'll tell you why in a minute how we know that Peter was on the other side of the horseshoe, maybe at the last seat, probably the second or the third one. He just went toward the end of the table. How do we know that? Well, let's look at our text. Look at John 13. And now this is getting ahead of us a little bit, but this is to sort of set the scene. Look at John 13:23. There was reclining on Jesus' breast one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Who was the disciple whom Jesus loved? Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when they make a distinction between the two most important Johns, John the Baptist and John the Apostle, the other disciples call John the Baptist, John the Baptist, and this John, just call him John. John, on the other hand, he calls John the Baptist just John, and calls himself the disciple whom Jesus loved. He's quite proud of that, I guess, as he should be. So he's referring to him. Now, how could he lay his head on Jesus' breast? You understand? Well, if they're lying parallel this way, lying on their elbow this way, and here's Jesus in the second seat, second bench, and then John is lying in front of him at the first seat on the horseshoe, which is not the master's seat. All he had to do is lean back and he could talk to Jesus. Put his head on his breast. You understand? We're just lying parallel. Just lean back and put his head on his breast. So we know John was sitting there. Simon Peter therefore gestured to him and said to him, "Tell us who it is of whom he was speaking." Jesus, and we'll come back, Jesus had said, "Somebody's going to betray me." And so Peter has to, he motions to John, "Ask him who it is. Ask him who it is." But you see, if they're lying this way, how could, if John's going to see Peter, Peter had to be on the opposite side of the table toward the end, maybe at the end. Understand? So here they are lying here, and John is laying his head back on Jesus' breast talking with him, and Peter's over here. And Peter says to him, "Ask him, ask him." Now, if Peter were sitting back up here, he couldn't see John. Understand? And John couldn't see him. I mean, he could see John, but John couldn't see Peter because you laid this way on your right elbow. You ought to follow that? So That's what made me. I say on the basis that I just make a guess that Peter normally was in Judas was next to Jesus behind him in the second, you know, in the seat, in these chief seats, but Judas took his seat, so Pete got mad. Jesus therefore answered, and he, that is John, leaning back on Jesus' breast, just leaned back and said to him, "Lord, who is it?" He could whisper that, couldn't he? Nobody else could hear because they're facing away from everybody else. Jesus therefore answered, "That is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him." And when he had dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas, Simon Iscariot. Now the other gospel writers say dipped in the dish with him, so we know that Judas was sitting next to Jesus. Also we read down, and after the morsel, Satan then entering into him. Verse 27, Jesus therefore said to him, "What you do, do quickly." Now no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he had said this to him. For some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, "Buy the things we have need of for the feast," or else that he should give something for the poor. That is, nobody, the other disciples, didn't know what Jesus said to Judas. Didn't know what was going on. And interesting, the other disciples were not in on the conversation between John. Note this, John leans back and says to Jesus, "Who is it?" Jesus says to John, and none of the rest of them hear it, "It's the one I give the morsel to." He reaches over and gives the morsel to Judas sitting next to him, leans back and says to Judas, "What you're going to do, do it now." Judas gets up and leaves, and the rest of them don't even know what's going on. How could they not know what's going on? Because that conversation was between these three on this end of the horseshoe who were facing this way. So John leans back and says something to Jesus that nobody can hear, and Jesus leans back and says something to Judas that the rest of them, they don't know why Judas is leaving. Now John knew, you understand? John knew, apparently, although John may not have heard what Jesus said to Judas, but John by this time knew who it was because Jesus told him, and apparently Jesus motioned for him to keep quiet, whatever. Y'all see that? So Judas gets up and leaves. Now, why did Jesus send Judas out? I think because he had some, and by the way, Judas was gone before he instituted the Lord's Supper, and he had some important things to say to these men, which didn't include Judas. So he gets rid of him. You know, you don't belong here anymore. And then he goes on and gives his instructions to the 11. Was that interesting to you? Well, that's the deal. You know, it makes it hard for you to appreciate Da Vinci's Last Supper anymore. But this was how they did it, and it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You know, how Peter could motion to him, and how the rest of them could see Judas go, but not know what was going on, why he left. Any questions on that? So the chief seat was the second from the end, let's say, on this. What a man would do is, the reason they did that, I can't, probably, this was the Roman custom too. They got this from the Romans. The honored guest would therefore be facing away from all the rest of them. And he could have a private conversation. The master of the feast could have a private conversation with the honored guest, and include the rest of them only if they wanted to. So they would, by lying this way, those two, they could carry on a conversation, have a private visit, and not involve everybody else.
That seems the most awkward way to eat.
Yes.
That I can think of. Why did
they eat lying down?
Yeah, on one arm.
Well. Don't really know. It was just a custom. Why do we eat and not put our elbows on the table? I usually put my elbows on the table, unless I'm in polite company. Why? It's so much easier, you know. It's a good question. Part of the reason is that if we spent 3 or 4 hours at a meal, we'd lie down too, probably. Very hard to sit up, and that's how long they ate. So in the ancient era, in this period, they would eat the custom. Now, it's hard to know. The Jewish custom by this period had intermingled with the Roman custom. What they would do is they didn't sit down for breakfast. The Romans didn't. And now what the Jews did exactly was something like this, depending on where they lived and how much of the custom they accepted. They would get up and and they get before daylight and eat very early. And usually what they ate for breakfast was something left over from supper. And then they would eat fruit in the afternoon, some light snack in the afternoon, but they only had one big meal a day. And it was a social event. They would eat, and they would begin eating after the sun went down, and they would eat till bedtime. And now, it didn't mean they ate all the whole time, but that was the time when all the family business was conducted. That was the time when, if they had guests, all the visiting was done. And they would bring several courses. Even if they were very poor, they would usually spend a long time eating. They didn't have to watch television or anything. And so they would often spend 2, 3, or 4 hours at the table. They would eat a while and talk, and then after a while another course would come in. And so they didn't gorge themselves all that time. But it was a very leisurely meal. Now, the rich people often would have orgies, and they would make orgies out of it, or they would make gluttonous feasts out of it, depending on what you wanted to do. But just because you spent a long time didn't mean you were a glutton. But they would just spend hours there, and they would eat, and so that's one of the reasons they reclined. Other reasons, I suggest custom. Yes?
Notice you said that Judas went out before the Lord's Supper. That's better than
excuse to be later. Yes, I know it has. Well, I think it's because John doesn't record the establishing of the Lord's Supper. I think that just because of the way he did it, the purpose of the meeting, because it's clear in John that he dismissed Judas before he got down to the business of the evening.
Yeah.
Could be. I haven't read through this for a long time. You might be right. I might have misspoken though. It's in my mind. Yeah, it's in my mind that he did. But you may be right. I'm glad you brought that up. I just don't recall. If you can find that, I'll be glad to, you know. Yes, ma'am. Well. Question is, when in this series of events did he institute the Lord's Supper? That doesn't say anything about the Lord's Supper, does it? Well, that's not really all that important. Remember I said that John, you go all the way through up to chapter, yes, sir?
The passage that I have in mind was in Luke 23.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And then in verse 21 it says, "Behold, the hand that one that betrayed me is with me on the table." That's right. Yeah, yeah. I stand corrected on that.
Well, I don't know that you're
correct. Well, yes. But at least he sent him out before this long conversation he had with the disciples about what was in store for them, what they were going to have to do. Now, again, this reflects the custom. You see, what they would do is they would get together and eat often what they call the meal, even though they might sit at the table for 3 or 4 hours, not always that long. They would often do almost all of their eating first, and then they would have a conversation. And by the way, the early church, which was reflected this, the first century church reflected this custom, in that, as I think I've mentioned before in another context, that when the early church met, they met in the evenings at mealtime, not in the mornings. Now, when the church was Jewish, they met on the Jewish first day of the week, which would be our Saturday night. But that was the first day of the week for them after 6 o'clock. When the church became predominantly Gentile, they met on Sunday night, which was the first day of the week according to the Roman calendar. It was always the first day of the week. But they met in the evening. In the early centuries, the church met in the evening, and they met at a mealtime, and they ate together. What they did on the Lord's Day, it was supper time, and so they all brought their meal together, and they ate. That was the agape, or the love feast, because that was the evening meal. And the teaching went on and the Lord's Supper in connection with that meal. So it fits in with that custom of the long drawn out. They would eat, and then they would have together, and they would have teaching. Remember, one time Paul preached till midnight, and Eutychus fell out of the window, and they would go on for a long time. The idea of meeting in the morning is the modern Western. Anything wrong with it? But I'm just saying that's how they did it. But it was that's one of the reasons they ate together. They met at mealtime and did it every first day of the week. Well, any questions on that? I don't want to. Let's get back to our. Any other? I appreciate you bringing that up. Any other points that need to be brought up? Okay. Now, we go back to chapter 13. Jesus, verse 5, he poured. Verse 4. Jesus rose from the supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself about. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Now, the ancient Near Eastern custom was that if there were servants in the house, the servants washed the feet of the guests. Now, washing of the feet was a custom of politeness. It was also a necessity. As you know, they traveled in dusty roads and bare feet, and they would wash. By the way, washing of the feet is a very comforting thing. Your son, you ever soak your feet? If you walked all day in shoes that weren't very good, and often the washing of the feet involved, they would apply oil to cuts. People, you know, very often feet would be cut if you travel very far, get into thorns or sharp stones. So the washing of the feet also involved medicating them. So it was common. And in that day, it's hard for us to imagine this, but in that day, if you got foot trouble, you were in real trouble. You couldn't get around. And so it was not only a custom, but it was a sign of courtesy. But it was also it met a real need that if a person traveled very far, they would come in, and the servants would wash their feet, put oil on any cuts, check them out, and also it's very relaxing. Feels very good. And why had one of the servants not done it here? Yeah, they didn't have, why? How do you know this? Well, my question is too vague. You see, what kind of place were they meeting in? In a borrowed room. It wasn't anybody's house. There weren't any servants. They just rented a room or borrowed a room. So there was no host family. You got that? No host family with servants. And as I reconstruct this, and again, I can't prove this, but it was a custom servants, then the lowest man on the totem pole had to wash the feet. So here the disciples walk in, and Judas takes Peter's seat, and Peter throws a fit and takes Judas' seat, or at least near the end. And everybody's looking around and say, okay, who's going to wash the feet? There's the bowl. The guy who provided the room apparently provided the bowl. The towel is there. The bowl is there. The man who provided the room did what was required. He provided the makings, the water and the towel. So they walked in and said, okay, who's going to do it? Who's going to admit that he's the least of all? Who's going to admit that he's the last man in line? And who did? Nobody. And the meal's already beginning, and it's past time for this to be done. And nobody's going to fess up and say, okay, fellas, I admit, I'm number 12, and I'll wash the feet. Nobody does it. And so, now the reason I say that is, I'm pretty sure about that, is because Jesus, I think, sees this. You know, they're eyeing each other. Who's going to get up and wash the feet? Who's going to say, okay, I'm the servant? And who does it? Jesus does it. And why does he do it? Well, we'll see. He does it to teach them something. Jesus, the master teacher that he is, uses that situation where everybody's too proud to wash the feet. He uses it to teach them a very basic principle, which he's been teaching them all along. This isn't a new principle. You all see that? So and by then, and then they're all humiliated. Guess finally somebody, they're all looking around, who's going to do it? And finally one does get up. And oh no, it's Jesus. He does it. He gets up and he takes he would take off his outer cloak, leaving a tunic they wore under it because he didn't want to get it dirty. and he would gird himself with a towel, and he started around to wash the feet. Now, and remember I said that in this trivium, this three-table arrangement, the feet were always away from the table, so they could eat, and the servants would go around and wash the feet when they could continue eating. You know, that's one of the things, that when I was growing up, when I was a little boy, and I saw Da Vinci's Last Supper, and I always pictured a servant under the table washing feet. You know, it must have been very uncomfortable. Some guy calling around under the table trying to wash. Well, of course, now I know that wasn't true at all. And interesting, one of the first ones he comes to is Peter, or it seems to be. And when you start washing feet, you would start at the bottom, work your way up. So Jesus gets up, and he picks up the basin and the towel, and he goes to the other end of the horseshoe, and he starts up, and he comes to Peter very quickly, either first or second or third, because we know Peter was over there because he was able to motion to John. Y'all see that? So, and Peter, well, let's go on. And so he came, look what it says. And he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girt. And he came to Simon Peter. Now, did he come first? Doesn't say that, does it? Could have. It's not clear from what's said. But he comes to him apparently early. And to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And he came to Simon Peter, and he said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? Surely you're not going to do this. By now, all the disciples, except for Judas, they're all wishing that they had done it. Well, I wish I'd done that. The Master's doing it. Now we know that Jesus is doing this for a teaching, because he gets down to teaching. Jesus answered and said to him, what I do, you do not realize now, but you shall understand hereafter. What I'm doing now, you're not going to understand now. You'll understand it later. Now, let me say a word about that. I wish I was spending too much. But that is a principle that Jesus used throughout his teaching ministry. It's like he would give people a package, and they'd unwrap it later. Or you get one of these packages that has, it's a gag gift at Christmas, a box within a box. He'd give them something, and they'd start looking at it. And only after he was gone did they realize what it really was. And he did many teachings like that. Many of his parables were like that, not fully understood until after the resurrection and the foundation of the church. Somebody has criticized the interpretation of John chapter 3, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he shall not inherit the kingdom of God. One argument against that being baptism, which is an invalid argument, says that, well, Jesus would not have told Nicodemus about baptism into Christ, the new birth, because that had not been instituted yet and would not be until the day of Pentecost. But Jesus did it all the time. He taught people things that they would fully understand later. So that argument will not hold up. Understand? That because it was ahead of time, that he wouldn't have taught anything ahead of time. Well, he did it all the time. There's a regular method. He does it here. That I'm going to do this now, and you're going to really understand later on the significance of it. That's beautiful, isn't it? Peter said to him, Never shall you wash my feet. I can see Peter drawing his feet up on the couch and said, oh no, you're not going to wash my feet. I think too much of you. And then he teaches them another lesson. If I do not wash you, you have no part with me. If I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Notice that he begins to use this occasion where he's washing the feet as a metaphor. In fact, that could be said about everybody, couldn't it? Jesus could say to every, and does say, by the way, Jesus says to every person who's ever lived, if I do not wash you, you have no part in me. And so the metaphor becomes very clear. You know something about metaphor? He uses this physical washing of feet as a metaphor for the spiritual cleansing through his blood. Simon Peter said to him, Now, if that's the case, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Well, then wash all of me. And Jesus said, now get carried away, Peter. implied. He who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. Now, what he's saying is this: no, I don't need to do that. I don't need to wash all of you with water. But why? You've had your bath for the day. Jews were very clean. They bathed every day. You've had your bath. I'm just washing your feet. You're all clean, except for one of you. Notice how Jesus uses this occasion to teach. First he teaches about this, then he teaches about this. Now he talks about Judas. He said, everybody here has had their bath. You're all clean. I just need to wash the feet, except one of you is dirty as a pig. Who was that? Judas. Again, he's speaking metaphorically. He's not clean. Why? Well, he knows what's in Judas' heart. That's very interesting, isn't it? For he knew the one, John tells us, who was betraying him. See, and you go back and read where Judas had already made his deal with the chief priests, already had it set up, and so that's what he was betraying. The plan was underway. For this reason, John explains to us, he said, not all of you are clean. But we already got it before John told us, didn't we? So when he had washed their feet, he washes everybody else's feet, and taken his garment and reclined at table again, put his cloak back on over his tunic, and took his place again at the table, he said to them, do you know what I've done to you? Did you learn your lesson? Well, you washed our feet. Nah, that's not the point, though. The problem is not dirty feet. Do you understand what I'm trying to teach you here? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, neither is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Now, what is the lesson? Here's the lesson. Did you learn this? He asks. You call me Lord and Master, you're right. And if I, the Lord and Master, washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. Now, was Jesus instituting foot washing? Now, by the way, some churches, a few groups, believe that Jesus at the Last Supper instituted two ordinances, the Lord's Supper and foot washing. And some groups still do it. There were some groups of the Anabaptists. It started in Germany. The largest existing group of the Anabaptists today are the Mennonites. Ever heard of the Mennonites? They practice foot washing. There are some other smaller groups that practice foot washing. They have the Lord's Supper and foot washing. Whenever they have the Lord's Supper, they also have foot washing. And the Pope, once a year, will wash the feet of the cardinals in Rome. Those are the groups I think of right away that practice this. Now, is he giving us what we call an ordinance, like the Lord's Supper, or is he teaching a principle? Well, how do you know? The way we answer that question is we ask, how did the disciples understand it? And how did the early church practice it? And we know from the book of Acts and from early Christian literature, the early church never practiced foot washing as a part of the Lord's Supper. Understand? It was never like an ordinance in the church. So they did not understand it as being like, you understand, when you come together, you wash feet and you have the Lord's Supper. They had the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, but they didn't wash feet as a religious practice, as a ritual, we might say. We don't like that word, but you understand? So it was very clear the early church didn't understand it that way. And in the book of Acts, you never read about it. You read about them coming together for the Lord's Supper. You never read about them, you know, as a matter of commandment, washing feet as a religious service. Any questions on that? So now, what is the principle? It is the principle, of course, and it's not too hard to understand, that you ought to wash one another's feet means... He didn't care about dirty feet, and he didn't care about social custom. What is his point? Service. You see, as I set this up, they all walk into this borrowed room, and they look around and say, who's going to be the loma? Who's going to be the least of all? Who's going to fess up and say, okay, I know, I'm the least of all? And Jesus said, now if I did this to you, who am properly called master and teacher, don't you think you ought to get the idea? That is, what he's saying to them is, as I understand it, that if you had the kind of spirit, I'm trying to deal with this in light of the context. That is, what is going on is that Jesus is preparing them for what they're going to face after he's gone. And he tells them many things that they're going to have to know if they're going to do the job that he is leaving for them to do. Now, I think looking at it in its largest context, I think what he's teaching them is this, that if you're going to be able to do what you're going to have to do after I'm gone, you're going to get over this arrogance you've got. You're going to get over this thing of sitting around and trying to say, well, I'm not going to wash his feet. There may be some, you'll be like, you just pick out any, just Bartholomew or Matthew, any of them, saying, well, somebody's got to wash feet, but it's not going to be me. Not going to be me. Let James do it. He's the youngest. And John, he's young too. Let the younger kids do it. I've been around too long. I'm not going to wash anybody's feet. Sound familiar? Yeah. Well, I became a disciple. I was a disciple 6 months before he was. We'll let seniority rule. He who came last, let him do it. Or any number of reasons they would give for not doing it. But Jesus said, now, is saying, let me repeat myself, if you're going to get this job done, you're going to have to wash one another's feet. You're going to have to get over that attitude and quit trying to be the master and start being the servant. Because in Christianity, now here's the bottom line, and this embraces many other teachings on this same general subject. In Christianity, it is the servant who is the master, who is the leader. And I remember I taught this when I had my little session on elders and deacons.
The biblical principle, which this is what separates the church and the Christian from the world. In the world, the one who is the master is the one who has some kind of delegated authority. And there's an element of that in the family and in the church. But ultimately, that is, when push comes to shove, one becomes a leader in the Christian family, and one becomes a leader in the church by being the best servant. That is, elders are servants of the church. They serve the church. You become a leader by example and by serving. And in the Christian home, when I teach seminars on the Christian family, that I tell the fellows in my family classes, it takes about 5 minutes to become the boss of the home, your biggest, but it takes years to become the leader of the home by virtue of being serving, you understand? Serving, now see, serving from authority is not, those two terms are not opposites. You can serve from a place of authority. Yes, sir. It might be a real object lesson. It sure would. It'd be very humbling, wouldn't it? And those who do it point that out. It's very therapeutic. However, I think that I think it wouldn't hurt. If somebody wanted to do it, I wouldn't object. I do think that there are plenty of other opportunities for washing feet, in the sense that he meant it. And I think that the church family regularly needs to remind itself that we are not here to lord it over each other. We are here to take care of each other. And that's one of the secrets to a happy church. I'm here to take care. Yes, sure would. I saw another hand. Yes, sir. And I think it's interesting. It's true. This was to be a sign of humility. And as a matter of fact, if it became a religious ritual, it becomes exactly that. For instance, I mentioned the Pope. Once a year, he'll wash the cardinal's feet, and everybody's there. They got the cameras there. And he started saying, okay, everybody, look, once you see how humble I am, I'm the most humble of all. You don't want to miss this. It's kind of like, you know, I had a friend in college as a nut who said he was going to write a book, My Humility and How I Obtained It. And he said the reason he was going to do that was, he said he was always very proud of his humility. Let me say a word about humility. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, that's what I was going to point. Humility is a very fragile thing. Just about the time you think you got it, you lose it. Now, that's not right. A Christian humility is a tougher thing than that. Christian humility is not always an earthly kind of meekness. It is a different kind of thing. Was Jesus humble? Yes. Was he humble when he cleansed the temple? Yes. Was he humble when he cursed the fig tree? Yes. In this genuine kind of humility, which I don't have time to go into. I saw one more hand, then we'll... Yes, sir. Yes. That's exactly... Look at verses 34 and 35, the last verses in our text. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, but that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have loved one for another. Well, many other things could be said, but our time's up. Thank you for your attention.